Okay, go ahead. This is side two now.
What those statistics clearly indicate is the 3-year law, the law requiring 3 years of residency, did not keep doctors out of Nevada. They poured in several thousand during that 15 or 12-year period. It didn't restrict any. And that, of course, was the that was one of the big arguments when I testified in favor of that law. Many other people said, well, we won't be able to get doctors here. They won't be coming. Well, that was nonsense. All you had to do look nationally and see that 98% roughly of every graduate of every medical school in the country, 15,000 graduates per year, 98% of them went into residencies of 3 or more year. I mean, it wasn't the norm. It was almost unanimous. Practically every kid getting out of medical school took a 3-year residency as a minimum. Family medicine was 3 years, internal medicine 3, pediatrics, etc. So, and we knew all those statistics. And so the argument that somehow this would restrict people coming to Nevada to practice is nonsense, was nonsense at the time. The last 15 years or so has proven it was nonsense. And yet the accommodation to rural communities has provided, and I must say there's some very good physicians, but what we were trying to do was to raise the standard of medical care through at least having well-trained physicians. Heck, we have a medical school now in Nevada. We're trying to train young physicians to be as up-to-date as possible. Why not insist that the doctors who get licensed, both our own graduates as well as those coming from out of state, the majority, by the way, because the medical schools only provided 300 or 400 of those graduates, that we should do our best to raise the standard of medicine, not come down to the least common denominator, but to set a standard that was nationally accepted. So, anyway, that was those were the major things that went on in my memory of the 16 years I was on the board.
It's interesting to me that, of course, we have unique problems here in Nevada,
mm-hmm.
as a few other states have, probably Wyoming, other places with lots of rural
mm-hmm.
Communities.
Mm-hmm.
So, within this overall umbrella of boards of medical examiners, every state can do whatever. There's not a uniformity.
You're absolutely.
Is there?
There was not in some.
Except by getting together and having meetings and comparing, and then maybe then going
right.
before the legislature.
Right.
The early ones must have been as different and diverse as what 48 states.
You're right, and now 50.
States.
And you're absolutely right. It's all part of the whole issue of states' rights. You know, a federation.
Mm-hmm.
Of states and states legislators having the prerogative of deciding who they're going to license, you know, to gamble, and who they're going to license to practice medicine. And so, yes, there's no question. And there's about 10 different models. There are some states which are all run by the state government, no doctors, it's all administrators. There's some that have an umbrella under the health department that controls all health-related, so it's nursing, medicine, chiropractic, podiatry, etc. Well, Nevada and several other states, particularly in the West, except California, have individual boards for each one of those.
Mm-hmm.
The Board of Medical Examiners has no authority over a podiatrist or a chiropractor or an optometrist or anybody else. So, so you're right, there's all sorts of models. Some of them have more control by physicians. Others have excluded physicians. They use physicians as consultants, and they see it as sort of a state regulatory, like the
sort of protects physicians. In
yeah,
a way, that's kind of good.
Yeah, but it's
because I'm sure that some of these people, like Dr. McLean, made a lot of enemies. He had a lot of respect at the same time, but you know he was almost autonomous.
Yeah, he was. Uh-huh.
Power.
Yeah, he had thick skin too. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I made a lot of enemies, and we all did. I mean, but that goes with the territory, and I'm sure that.
Policing yourself.
Yeah, there's several physicians who I still see from time to time in social events or others who turn around and walk the other way and won't.
Mm-hmm.
And but that's too bad. The evidence that we had was that they deserve to be disciplined. and the evidence they had that that they were impaired by drugs or alcohol, and they had to be taken out of the profession and sent to get help. Now, I also say, I can. There's lots of people who can testify to this, that in the issue of drug and alcohol, it was really an issue of tough love. Yes, you are a physician, you are a colleague, but you are a danger to your patients and you're an embarrassment to our profession, and you got to get help. And I could name, which I won't, because it's confidential, a number of physicians in Las Vegas and Reno and even some of the rural communities who have gone away for treatment, have come back and in recovery, have publicly acknowledged their addiction, have talked to medical students and nurses about it, are back in practice, practicing very good medicine, and are of absolutely no danger to anybody. The board always took the position, and I think it's the right position, the board took the position that addiction is not a reason to have your license taken away. Addiction is the disease. But if you use the drug of addiction, then you're impaired. So the fact that you're addicted never led to any action by the board. As long as you got off drugs or alcohol, you entered AA, you went into a physician's impaired physician's program, which the State Medical Association set up a number of years ago, to their credit, had a wonderful... So we had a place to send people, professionals, many themselves who had been in recovery. And even today, the Physicians Assistance Committees in the various state and county medical societies are made up of physicians who are in recovery. And they don't say, I'm recovered, past tense. They don't say I'm cured. They say I'm in recovery, and their attitude...
As an alcoholic.
Right. It's for life.
Always says,
it's for life.
Alcoholic.
I'm an alcoholic every day of the year. And I, so I think rather than putting our head in the sand and ignoring it, as was done for a long time, back to your question about did we as a profession cover up, I think we as a profession or individually, along with family members and others, were enablers. We enabled it, particularly if the physician had a particularly good reputation, his partners or her partners and colleagues didn't want to blow the whistle, they looked the other way, they were afraid this person would lose their livelihood. Hospitals were very, very leery about this whole area. They didn't know how to deal with it. So in fact, when the board took on a major responsibility, not the only, but a major responsibility for this area, I think there was a sigh of relief among many physicians and the public and a lot of others.
Hospital
administrators, because they've talked to me and they've told me, thank goodness you're doing something about this. And even the physicians, many of them who were screaming and yelling and angry and cursing me and yelling at me in behind closed doors that I was ruining their lives, etc. Not me, but the whole board, but I was the secretary, so I took the brunt of a lot of that, came back later and said, you know, I was in denial. I'm glad I was pushed. Thank you. I'm now back in practice. I realize what my disease is. And others who haven't said boo since, that's okay. I wasn't in the business to get thanked. But what I'm saying is nationally, the 10 or 12% of physicians who are impaired, thousands of physicians have now gone to the program in Georgia, started by Doug Talbot. And there are now programs all over the country who are back in practice.
What is that program?
Doug Talbot is a recovering alcoholic who, when he was in Georgia, along with others, recognized this problem in the early 70s, I think. It's been 25 years now. Essentially, with the help of the Georgia Medical Association, started the first impaired physicians program in the country. That's what they called it at the time. And they set up a unit in a local hospital, which at that time had a heavy psychiatric bent. And they would intervene, as they called it, on their colleagues. And he and others would go and confront their colleagues about their addiction and slowly started writing in the literature, gathered statistics, showed that you could get physicians back into practice. The other thing was fascinating, which we presented to our own legislature. There was literature from Oregon. When Oregon, prior to getting a law similar to ours, disciplined alcoholic physicians, didn't try to help them, just disciplined them and took away their license, they had a very high suicide rate. There was a rash of, their suicide rate was, I don't know, above 50% of the physicians, because the attitude back before 1975, 1980, in that period of time, the attitude was you are an embarrassment to the profession, you ought to be drummed out of the corps, your license is taken away. Well, to a physician who, especially a physician who's addicted and impaired, he or she will give up family and money and all sorts of things, but they'll hold on tightest to their license and to their MD. It's part of their identity and their self-identity. Very high suicide rate. When Oregon changed their law and their attitude, and I spent several days up there, we copied some of their stuff. They were very helpful. As a matter of fact, I said earlier, some consultants from Oregon came and helped us. When they changed their attitude and set up an impaired physicians program like Georgia and began to say to their colleagues, look, we are not going to take away your license. We're not here to destroy your life, but we are here to protect the public. That's our duty. And you are going to get help with your disease, or we'll take away your license. It became a carrot and a stick, which we adopted. Well, once that happened, the number of licenses revocations dropped for alcohol. It has dropped to practically none. And there were no more suicides. And I've forgotten the exact figure, but in the range of 90%, 85 or 90% of the physicians who had been sent into a rehabilitation program returned to practice and practiced fine. And Georgia has the same statistics, and it's been the same thing here in Nevada. When you offered help to a physician, you threatened him, of course, with loss of license, but we're offering you first a voluntary, confidential option to go into therapy, deal with your addiction, come back, you'll be monitored. And as a matter of fact, the one reason we expanded our expanded our number of investigators, we started a monitoring program where, by law, physician had no choice. If he or she was in a recovery program, our investigators could walk into their office day or night and say, urinate in the bottle, with unannounced check on their urine for drugs and alcohol.
Oh, I could see some people not going along with this.
Well, they tried not to, but they had no choice, because the choice was, if you refuse to cooperate, you automatically have agreed that your license will be revoked instantaneously. And I did suspend two physicians' license overnight. Just called them on the phone, your license is suspended, the investigator will be by tomorrow. And then I would call, of course, the people on the impaired physicians program and say, you better go see Dr. So-and-so. He refuses to cooperate. It means he's probably on the sauce, or he's on the drugs or whatever. And they would intervene and ship him off too. Because there was a relapse rate. But that also became a very potent stimulus to stay in recovery. You never knew when the Board of Medical Examiners was going to have some investigator on your doorstep.
Was there a cap? You know, how many times could a person...
Anytime. Well, anytime we had reason to do it, we'd just do it randomly. That's the whole idea.
Go away for treatment, come back, go away for treatment again.
No, as a matter of fact, I don't think we had anybody who went more than twice. Well, we might have had a few that went three times.
Small, yes.
Most of them after one, because most of them went to the Georgia program and to the one in Oregon, and there were several others around the country. Most of those for physicians were fairly long programs, 2 to 3 months. It's been shown in the literature that physicians have a very strong denial mechanism and defense mechanism, and the usual 4-week hospital inpatient detoxification with follow-up on the outpatient for most alcoholics who are non-physician, that seems to be enough. But most everybody who deals with physicians says that's not enough. They need longer time. They're dealing often with long suppressed emotional and psychological problems, as well as, and by their own admissions, when you listen to physicians who, and I've gone to many of these conferences where the entire audience practically was were people in recovery, and AA meetings, most of them say that they began their alcohol in high school, mm-hmm. in college, mm-hmm. medical school. And they were so bright, many of them, that they could be stoned and still pass an exam, or they could be in the class half hungover and still pass exams. And they could get through residencies, and they could work day and night. And if they looked exhausted, they were excused because they were working so hard. And then they were so, they could cover it up in their practices for long periods of time. I mean, you listen to, I'm not making this up, these are their stories that... It often took a very heavy stick with a very nice carrot. Here's your choice. And I've said that, confronted a number of physicians when I was the secretary, and as I said earlier, many of them didn't like it. I said, here's your choice. And we would frequently have members of the physician's assistant committee come to the board and be sitting in another office when I and the investigative committee confronted these physicians, said, here's the evidence, here's your urines, here's what we got. Now, in the other room over there, there's a couple of your colleagues who will help you. If not, we'll have a court order suspending your license tomorrow morning. It's up to you. That's a pretty, and but even that wasn't as important, and then I'll stop, wasn't as important, frankly, as the being confronted by colleagues. Many physicians said being confronted by colleagues, all or almost all, not everyone, but most of whom had been through what you've been through.
Oh.
They've been in recovery. They are in recovery. They know what, so they know all
they
you.
They could respect that other person.
Respected, but also knew every excuse.
The other person wasn't being holier than thou, because the other person had been through it.
Correct. And also knew every ploy in the book, knew every diversion,
sure.
knew every way to deny, knew every excuse known to mankind, because they had all used them. And what I hear from my colleagues who are in recovery is they are the best liars in the business. They can convince lots of people. And if they can convince their wives and their family and their colleagues and other enablers that, well, I won't ever take another drink and I'll be fine, I'm doing fine, I was just depressed, you know, for a few days, give me another break. We said, sure, we'll give you another break, but we're going to check your urine and your blood whenever we want to, not when you call. I mean, it's been demonstrated that if you call a doctor on the phone and say, well, we'll be by next Wednesday afternoon to check your blood and urine, I mean, you know,
sure.
you just stop using whatever you're using, and that's who's kidding who.
Is this still going on?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. It's a very good program.
Mm-hmm.
It's all confidential. And the people involved.
Does it go on any record?
All over the country.
Public record.
Oh, no public record.
If a person were to
no, the only
have some sort of disciplinary action.
Oh, then that's a public record. That's a public record.
No, but he's confronted. And it goes on his record. I mean, you have some records you keep.
Correct.
That so-and-so is in a recovery.
Correct.
He leaves here.
Right.
He goes away.
Never.
Another state.
Never is revealed. By law, it must remain confidential.
It is not then part of his
public record. As a matter of fact, two separate files are kept.
Uh-huh.
The public file, which is where he came from, where he went to school, any public disciplinary. Now, let's say a physician had his license suspended or revoked publicly because of his refusal to enter a program. Yes, that's now part of his public record. Just as the public record would include malpractice suits that were adjudicated against him, and he had to pay $1 million settlement. That's all public. Okay. The investigative file, including anything to deal with drugs or alcohol, if he or she voluntarily enters a treatment program, that's all kept in a separate file and in an entirely different part of the board office, and is not given to anyone. The only ones who see that are the attorneys and the investigator, of course, who puts the file together, and the investigative committee, the three members of the board who, for that period of time, usually a year or two, constitute the investigative committee. They're all privy to that information, and they're bound by oath not to reveal that. But the law says you can't. But so no, you're right. There's, but anything that is public, a public reprimand, as here,
I've seen those.
Public disciplinary action, a license suspended because of drug or alcohol, or fined because of some fraudulent behavior, whatever. Whatever the public record says, this, that goes with you. Mm-hmm. Wherever you go, stays here. And it's printed in this, which goes to all physicians in every hospital and all legislators and everybody else. This is, so the legislature, in giving the Board of Medical Examiners and the profession considerable leeway to deal with these problems, also expects accountability. And so I think that it's worked out, Eileen, I think, to be a fairly fair system.
So if someone goes to Utah,
yeah,
right here,
right,
and you get a call, the Board of Medical Examiners gets a call from the Board of Medical Examiners there in Utah.
Yes.
You're free to divulge this information, because he's not going to divulge it when he appears at the place in Utah. This gives you this freedom to...
Yes, and we have under the law the ability to in writing, mm-hmm, and in written requests. We don't believe anybody over the phone. You don't know who you're talking to. But in writing, we have the ability to transmit information on physicians to any other duly constituted board. Also, the Federation of State Medical Boards of the United States, which has its offices in Fort Worth,
keeps... Oh, so there is a federation. That's what I wondered.
I'm
there
sorry.
There is a national...
The National Federation, yes.
Over...
It was established 25, 30 years ago.
Okay.
But it's like any other federation. It's a voluntary participation by state boards, and there was a couple of years where several state boards didn't want to participate, but now I understand all 50 state boards participate, plus some osteopathic boards. And they have a national computer data bank, so that whenever a public action is taken against a physician, it's sent by computer almost instantaneously to Fort Worth. So this doctor leaves Nevada and goes to New York. The New York board can tap into the computer in Fort Worth and find out that 2 years ago in Nevada, even if he doesn't divulge it, was reprimanded for a public reprimand for whatever he was publicly reprimanded for. Now, every state followed our lead and several others in our application for initial licensure and our renewal every 2 years. We ask you about 40 questions, including, are you? What have you? And if it says on the bottom, if you withhold information or lie or fail to reveal, and that is discovered, that's a reason for an automatic revocation of your license. So the physician who says, oh, I can go to some other state, or I can come to Nevada and I'll fool them, they'll never know what happened to me in Ohio or Nebraska. Well, we may not if you don't tell us, or we may not if the computer doesn't have it in there. But if we eventually find out, we'll be sitting on your doorstep with a revocation simply because you've lied. I mean, so what, and as I said earlier, we know a lot about physicians from other states who have come here. They've been up front. They've told us what the problem was. We've gone to that state, gotten all the records, hearing transcripts. I've read transcripts 5 inches thick. And the board sat and talked to the physician. We saw what the disciplinary action was. We saw what remediation the physician went through, such as recovery for alcohol, and have licensed such physicians. It's not an automatic denial.
This could take a lot of your time.
It takes the time of all those 9 investigators,
yeah.
And, oh gosh, yes, enormous amount of time.
Tell me, in all the years that you were on it, any real disappointments?
That's a very good question. Disappointments.
Why am I doing this? This isn't worth it. This isn't working.
Well, no, I don't think. I don't feel that at all. I'm very happy with...
You were satisfied.
Well, not perfect. There were times
when... you were making changes, obviously. It wasn't perfect. You had to change with the times. and the growth.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I was a part of that, so that was very rewarding. Also, we saw lots and lots and lots, thousands, as the statistics show you, of wonderful young doctors coming to Nevada to practice. So I always would remind myself, and I'd come home at night after a particularly bad day or a horrendous hearing where I listened to stuff that would just make you, your hair stand on end, and you say, you know, how could, I mean, it's an embarrassment, how could any physician do what he or she did? And you just want to scream. But you have to keep reminding yourself, for the few physicians that got into all sorts of horrendous problems and did reprehensible things and were unethical and immoral, the vast majority of the physicians were good people treating their patients well, practicing. So I always, and so I've often said that, yeah, in that position and from that view, you saw the seediest side of your profession, and it wasn't terribly rewarding. And there were times you said, "Oh, I."
It's an eye opener.
Yeah, I want to get out of this. The hell with it. But I think I felt more like that before the law was changed, because we felt so frustrated and unable to do things. The new law after 85 provided the tools for the board to act. And I also have to say, the other great reward was a lot of the physicians who were impaired getting into recovery and coming back into practice, and at some point later thanking me and other members of the board. Because we used to make a policy of, and we still do, of when a person would come back in recovery and had been in recovery for a year or two, we'd invite them to a confidential meeting to tell us about their experience and to tell us how they felt about the board and its behavior toward them and to the problem. And many of them said, "I hated you at the time, but now 2 years later, I think you did the right thing and I wouldn't change it." And we'd get their recommendations. Well, what would you do? Many of them would say, do the same damn thing. Force the physician to get help, because very few physicians, at least when it comes to drug and alcohol, will get help by themselves. But then the ones where there were physicians who were disciplined for sexual behavior with patients, inappropriate sexual contact, that I guess was the most depressing to me, that physicians would use their authority and power, because physicians do have power over patients when the patient is sick, to use that for their own sexual gratification, to me, was far worse than addiction from drug and alcohol.
You could have the tolerance for the alcohol.
Yeah, or maybe.
What about ability to pay at these treatment programs?
That was a problem for some, but many would borrow.
Mm-hmm.
Many would take out loans. The Physicians Assistance Committee themselves would provide some scholarship. Many of them that would go to the in-hospital program in Georgia and in Oregon would their health insurance programs would pay for a part of it. Many of them would use health insurance to pay for it. I'm not too privy to that. And of course, many of them did go into debt, there's no question. But most of the physicians went back into practice and were able to deal with it financially. The alternative was no practice at all. So you say, well, you know, two tough choices, but the worst choice is being out of practice. And as I said earlier, in Oregon, before these self-help programs started, the whole issue of suicide, which in itself is terrible. But back to your question, disappointments, frustration, yeah. But no, I think the other thing is, I was so involved with the medical school, and I was seeing so many of our own graduates coming back, because our first graduates returned in 78, 79. The very first group that left here in 73 were coming back 6-7 years later. So from around 79, 80 on, I was seeing, among all these physicians getting licensed, a significant number of our own alumni. And it was wonderful to see them coming, beautifully trained, wonderful experiences, excellent credentials, coming and entering the profession. So that was a joyous thing, because I would make it a point to,
we shook hands with practically every doctor. For years, you know, we insisted that everyone for a license had to show up and actually meet the board. We haven't done that in the last couple of years because the numbers are so horrendous. I wanted to get to one question you asked earlier about there's nothing national. Well, there is no national licensure, you're correct, but
the fact... No uniform.
Right, no, right, yeah. Uniform. But part of that has changed. I was on the National Board of Medical Examiners for a couple of years. I haven't mentioned that yet. And I was a member of the board, and I also served on several of the committees that wrote exams. And for about 20 years, starting in the mid-70s, so I was a part of this, the Federation of State Medical Boards that I just mentioned and the National Board of Medical Examiners and the education committees of the AMA used to have joint meetings. They used to meet in Chicago. And then they started meeting in Atlanta and Dallas, all over the place. And they worked toward a uniform one way of getting a license in the United States, a uniform licensing exam, which would then all physicians, whether they were foreign trained or American trained, national American citizens or international citizens, all of them would take one exam. It would replace the national board. It would be taken over 2 or 3 years, several days at a time. And so that was a really satisfying to see that approved a couple of years ago. It's now called the USMLE, the United States Medical Licensing Exam. All 50 states now require it. It has replaced FLEX, which was for foreign graduates. It's replaced all state exams, because I took a state exam in 1966 when I came to Nevada. It's replaced the national board exam that all medical students take. Now, everyone who wants a license in any of the 50 states, beginning with sophomore medical students, senior medical students, interns and residents, just similar model, they take 6 days of written examinations over those 3 or 4 years. They take 2 days at the end of the second year, 2 days at the end of their senior year, 2 days sometime during their after their internship. And that now is given internationally. It's given in Calcutta, in Bombay, and given in Hong Kong. It's given in Manila. So no longer, and the reason for that was to answer the fundamental assumption in your question, how can states say that foreign graduates and American graduates, or people from Idaho and people from Nevada and people from Chicago, all have some common level of knowledge? So through the, and it was a lot of politics and it went on for a long time, but over those 20 years, ultimately it was passed a few years ago, and now there is no such thing as the National Board anymore. There's no such thing as FLEX anymore. There's no such thing as state exams. Every state in the union now accepts the United States Medical Licensing Exam, and that is the final common pathway, if you will, for a licensure in this country. Now, states still reserve the right to give an oral exam or to have an exam on our law. If you apply to Nevada, and many states do this, for a license, you're sent a copy of that little booklet, that 40-page booklet, and you're given an open book written exam, so you can look up the answers. And then you sign a certificate, and the passing grade is 100. You got to get everyone right, because you just read them up in the book. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, that helps later. You can no longer claim that ignorance of the law was my excuse for not doing something. I didn't know that I had to tell you if I moved my office address. I didn't know I had to tell you whatever. I didn't know that I had to tell you if I was disciplined in another state, because the law said it. So many states now require physicians entering their state to pass a written exam on that state's law. And if I went to New York tomorrow, I'd probably have to take their exam. So that was another innovation that we put in early in our law. So disappointing, what other, I can't think of others.
Did it lower the standards by making it national? Because I remember when a lot of physicians came here before they would complain, they came here from somewhere else, had a license in another state, but they didn't have the basic sciences. I think it was, that they were complaining about that was required.
Yeah, I had to take the basic science. Do you remember that? I had to take the basic science exam, yeah.
And they didn't have to take it in the state that they were in. So did this lower the standard?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, it raised the standard because...
did they use the highest?
Yes, they wrote a
denominator then instead of the
yes,
down to the lowest?
Yes, because the first part of the United States Medical Licensing Exam was very much like the first part of national boards. It was rewritten, but it didn't want to discriminate against the foreign graduate, but it essentially asked in the first part, which was a 2-day exam, usually taken by students at the end of their sophomore year. It was all basic science. It was very little, there was some clinical medicine, but so it didn't lower the standard at all. It raised the standard, but it also unified the standard. That is, every doctor getting licensed in any of the 50 states all at least begins with the same database. They all begin having passed the same exam. That's the purpose of it. So that was another innovation that took place in the last couple of years.
A lot of doctors maybe don't know this.
Oh, yeah, they do now. I mean, if they've read that newsletter.
Because this is, so this will come out in the book. A lot of them have been in practice for so many years, they don't know what the new...
No, most of them don't care, but if they read the newsletter that comes out, and this was written up a lot in the New England Journal of Medicine, is written up in JAMA. It was written up in a lot of areas. There are physicians, for example, there are people who argue that what we ought to do is do away with state general license and go to specialty licenses. But there's been a lot of fighting about that, and I don't think I know all the arguments pro or con, but there are people who say, you give a general license, right? Yes. Well, this guy's had 3 years of pediatrics, and that lady's had 4 years of OB, and that man's had 7 years of neurosurgery, and you're just giving him a general license. The answer is yes. Under state law, here and in all the other states, you essentially get a license to practice medicine and surgery. What prevents you from practicing neurosurgeon when you're not trained is malpractice and hospital privileges. Mm-hmm. Who's going to let you do neurosurgery if you haven't any training? But yes, there are people with limited training who try to do things that they're not trained to do. Well, then what generally happens is if they get into trouble, they can either be disciplined on an administrative level at the Board of Medical Examiners, or they can lose their privileges at a local hospital, as you know, or they can be sued by the family or the patient and end up with a horrendous civil suit. And if they are really off the wall and someone dies, they can even be prosecuted under a criminal law for a felony. So there's a number of different ways where a physician's freedom, if you will, to practice any kind of medicine are limited by either the possibility of civil suit or administrative action. But yes, frankly, under the law, if I wanted to attempt to practice psychiatry, which I wouldn't, or wanted to do dermatology, which I wouldn't, or tried to do neurosurgery, I'd never get privileges anyplace, I could attempt it.
But in your office only.
Right,
yeah.
Where no one was watching over my shoulder. But I wouldn't try it. Of course not. So there are those using that kind of argument who say what we really ought to do is say, you're trained as a neurosurgeon, that's what you get licensed for. You're trained as a psychiatrist, that's what you get licensed for. You're trained as a pediatrician, that's what you get licensed for. And if you step over the boundaries, then we'll discipline you. Well, I guess it could be done, but I don't know exactly how you could to regulate or monitor such a thing.
Well,
in that sense, a license, as you suggested earlier, a license is the least common denominator.
Mm-hmm.
But we raised the bar by getting in the 3-year residency to increase the quality. And this United States medical licensing nationwide has also raised the bar. But excuse me, I interrupted you.
That's what I wondered, if it had done that. Well, the physicians in their own specialty get boarded.
They get boarded? And they also can get get thrown out of their own specialty because they violate their own code of ethics. You're right. And if they don't stay abreast in their surgical field and some patient is injured, they can lose their privileges at the hospital, or their restricted privileges. or they can get sued and end up with a big malpractice suit if it can be proven. So there are lots of checks and balances on physicians, and some physicians would argue too many. You know, this is just big government telling me what to do. Well, yeah, maybe in a way, but frankly, I think
it's a profession, policing itself.
And I think you just said it. I think my part of mine and Ted and Jacobs and other people who have served on the board or have been consultants, we've, as I said earlier, we've had hundreds of physicians who have consulted for the board and are very supportive. It is a profession policing itself. Yes, with the arm of the state, yes, with the backing of a law, but I certainly would rather have it that way than in some states where physicians are sort of pushed to the side and you have a state agency set up with some bureaucrats and a whole bunch of lawyers and they wait for someone to get hurt or wait for some complaint and then they prosecute and get into a big legal hassle. Yes, we've done that too, but frankly I think it's a better system. So, and there are also those who think that if you get a license in one state, you ought to be able to carry it to all 50 states. And there are people in the federal government who argue that. But a lot of states aren't going to go for that simply because it does limit their ability to control commerce within their own states. And states have, you know, you don't get a license in one state to drive a car. Every state you go to, they say you need a new license to drive in our place. And we don't say if you get accepted to Harvard, you ought to be able to go to Berkeley. We don't say if you get accepted to one university, any other, you know. So I think the idea that license in one state should allow you to go any place you want will fly. I do think
I don't think it will fly.
Yeah. But I do think that the idea of some more uniformity of standards does make sense. If you're a board-certified surgeon, you have passed a national exam, and you can call yourself a board-certified surgeon nationwide. So, anyway,
so we're going in the right direction.
I think
this
so.
Is what we have now, and it's working.
And it may evolve.
Okay, we'll stop now.
Okay, good.